The Republican National Convention kicks off in Charlotte, North Carolina today. In contrast to the DNC's virtual convention last week, the GOP is offering 4 days of a hybrid, some in person and some online events, beginning with the roll call today.
Massachusetts proudly and enthusiastically casts our 41 votes for one of the greatest patriots in the history of this nation, our president, Donald Trump.
That was Bristol County Sheriff Thomas Hodgson casting 41 votes for President Trump for the state of Massachusetts in Charlotte. WBUR's Callum Borchers is back with us to talk about what to expect from this week's convention. Hey there, Callum.
Hey there, Tiziana.
So tell us about the roll call today, which has already happened, and how New England participated, Callum.
Yeah, well, as we heard a moment ago, Sheriff Thomas Hodgson spoke and delivered the nomination from Massachusetts. He's the honorary chair of Trump's reelection campaign here in Massachusetts. But he's really a polarizing figure, Tiziana. I think that his representation really sort of set the tone for this convention in a way. Remember that a federal judge said in May that Hodgson has disregarded the health of ICE detainees in his custody and likely violated their constitutional rights. He's known as an anti-immigration hawk. Our Shannon Dooling reported just a couple of months ago on a tie that he wore in an old portrait that resembles the Confederate flag. So that's the character who was representing Massachusetts today. And, you know, we heard that bit where he called Trump one of the greatest patriots in American history. He was sort of putting him in the same company as Paul Revere, Benjamin Franklin, Samuel Adams. So certainly some folks will agree with that. Many from Massachusetts will feel very strongly that that is not a good comparison. And it was quite a spectacle today, Tiziana, this roll call. We had Mike Pence, the vice president, speaking in the middle at one point. The president himself made an appearance after Florida was mentioned. As far as other New England representation, of course, Rhode Island got so much attention for the calamari last week. So the calamari did get a shout out again today from Rhode Island. And also Corey Lewandowski, the former Trump campaign chairman, former campaign manager, I should say. He's from New Hampshire. So he did the role for his home state of New Hampshire. Talked about his own book being a New York Times bestseller and also waded into the culture wars, talking about how we stand for the flag and kneel only for God.
Okay, so the DNC last week was all virtual, Callum. So, you know, Massachusetts delegates were cast from, I think, in front of the State House virtually. But some parts of the RNC are in person. So how will that compare?
Yeah, it is going to be more of an in-person component than what the DNC had a week ago. The roll call today, for example, was mostly in person. There were some folks appearing on video screen, but it's kind of this hybrid model, and it's really sort of a political statement, Tiziana. You know, and we heard it from the president today when he spoke, sort of complaining about the Democratic governor of North Carolina and his view being too harsh in the coronavirus restrictions. So this is a statement that Republicans are saying, look, we're not going to be deterred from gathering, at least entirely in person, in the way that the Democrats were. So it seems sort of odd in a way because it's a public health issue, but it has become a political issue in this campaign as well.
So the president is slated to appear every day of the convention. Traditionally, presidents have come in on Thursday night. He will appear every day, mostly in prime time, but he did show up. It sort of claimed as a surprise, but there was a lot of hinting that he was going to be there and spoke after the roll call. What was the message?
Right. I mean, and again, just the appearance is sort of a message in itself. He had agreed to not accept the nomination in Charlotte. He's going to do that from the White House on Thursday, but did make his physical appearance after all. So we can sort of say that he wasn't scared away entirely. As I mentioned, faulted Roy Cooper, the Democratic governor, for the restrictions in that state. He continued to sow doubt about the accuracy of mail-in voting and the integrity of the election, saying that he's not sure whether you'll be able to tabulate the results. He complained about press coverage, as is his custom. He also hinted that the coronavirus response and his handling of the virus is going to be a theme, or at least a major theme, of his acceptance speech on Thursday. So I think that's going to be interesting. I think that for people who are loyal to the president, at least recently, that's become one reason for them to maybe a little bit shaky in their support of him. And I think that he's going to try this week to shore up that support and defend his response.
So, Callum, we know that primetime convention, even remote or hybrid, the speakers are a big deal. Who are the other prominent speakers scheduled for this week? And does New England make any kind of a showing?
Yeah, I would say tonight that the former UN ambassador Nikki Haley and Senator Tim Scott are kind of the highlights for tonight. Later on in the week, you also have some big names in Washington, like Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, the Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is there. But there are also a lot of big political players who are not going to Siana. And so what you have is kind of a family affair in a way. There are seven, count them, seven Trumps speaking at this convention. So the president, obviously, the First Lady Melania, Don Jr. is also speaking. Ivanka Trump is speaking. Eric Trump, Tiffany, Lara Trump, and Kimberly Guilfoyle, who has been dating Don Jr. for a couple of years. So a lot of Trumps involved. You asked about a New England connection. Not really a whole lot of that. Maybe you could sort of count Dana White. He's the UFC president, the Ultimate Fighting Championship president. He's a Connecticut native, but that's just about it for New England connections on the speaking stage.
Okay, so is there anyone that it's surprising is not on the speaking stage or present? And what does that say about the current state of the Republican Party?
Well, you know, not so much on an individual level, but at least in the roles that they have, Tiziana, I do think that there are some really big gaps. For example, Charlie Baker is not going to be participating in this convention. Now, that's no surprise. We know that he skipped 2016 as well. He's no fan of this president, but he is a Republican, obviously. And typically, if you had a Republican governor who was one of, if not the most popular governors in the country, who has generally received high marks for his coronavirus response, you would want to feature that person. In fact, we saw Democrats featuring a lot of their popular governors last week. So it is notable that somebody in his position won't be there. It's also notable that the last Republican nominee from 2012, Mitt Romney, is not going to be participating. And of course, Romney has been a vocal critic of the president. And again, you see that contrast where last week the Democrats rolled out many previous nominees to tout Joe Biden. Also, no Bill Weld, you know, who was the runner-up in the Republican primary this year, challenging the president. And again, typically at a convention like this, you see people who were runners-up in the primary, they get a speaking slot, and maybe they, you know, I should say maybe, of course, they wish that they were the one accepting the nomination, but they usually say, hey, we got to unite the party, rally around the president. And that is definitely not what Bill Weld is doing. In fact, I spoke with him today, and he said that even though he's a Republican, he's actually going to urge voters to elect Joe Biden.
I've said right along that I would never support Donald Trump to be reelected president of the United States. His modus operandi since day one was to divide the country. And, you know, it worked once. We'll see whether he can sell that dog food again. I don't think so.
And so Weld says, Tiziana, that his focus in the coming months is going to be on get out the vote efforts, especially on voting by mail.
So it sounds like New England does not feature large into who is speaking, but does, in fact, feature large into who isn't speaking, Callum. We've already heard a bit about this during the roll call, but aside from getting the president reelected, what are the big agenda items for the Republican Party that we might hear about this week?
I'd say a couple things stood out. You know, one is trying really hard to hold on to their majority in the Senate. I think that Democrats certainly believe they have an opportunity to flip the Senate in the fall, and so the Republicans want to make sure that doesn't happen. One that came up specifically during the roll call today was from Alabama, hoping that they can elect Tommy Tuberville, the former Alabama Auburn football coach in the state of Alabama, but Auburn football coach. He's trying to oust Doug Jones, who, of course, beat Roy Moore a couple of years ago. It's unusual to have a Democrat representing Alabama in the Senate, so that's one that they think that they can steal back. And then the other one I would say that's going to be a big theme is nominating conservative justices. That, of course, is a big selling point for sort of Trump-wary Republicans who might hold their nose and say, you know, I don't love him, but I want to get conservatives on the Supreme Court. And Trump sort of highlighted that a little bit today. In fact, he said that he's going to announce a new list of possible nominees in the next few weeks, similar to what he did in the 2016 campaign.
So, Callum, Massachusetts, the GOP here, has replaced Charlie Baker with Donald Trump on their webpage. And as the sort of the figurehead of the party, about 1 million people in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts voted for Donald Trump in 2016. Do we know if those numbers have held in 2020 or are going to hold?
It's such a good question because, of course, this is a very blue state, but in raw numbers, you're right. I mean, there were a lot of Donald Trump voters 4 years ago. If you go by the polling, he does seem to have lost a little bit of that support. So in 2016, he got about 34, you know, roughly a third of the vote in the general election in Massachusetts. In our last WBUR poll, he's down to 27% support. So if you go by that, he's lost, call it 7 percentage points over the last 4 years. And our Anthony Brooks also reported recently on this phenomenon. He described the mixed feelings that that some Trump voters from 2016 have about reelecting the president. You know, there are some who look at him and say, look, he's mostly delivered on what I was hoping for. But you have others who continue to be put off by his tone, and it's become something that bothers them more over the years. And you also have some that are disappointed in his record. For example, you know, he ran on build the wall. Well, the wall is not built, and Mexico certainly hasn't paid for it. And so I think that you sort of have this mix of some who have grown to dislike the president's rhetoric more and more, and others who maybe liked what he's been saying all along, but they're just disappointed that he hasn't delivered the way they hoped.
Well, we will continue to watch all of this with you. That's WBUR's Callum Borchers. Thanks, Callum.
Glad to be with you, as always.
We have some sad news to report now. Anthony Martin Yeti has passed. He was 63. Martin Yeti was perhaps best known as the 12-year-old boy running through the streets of the North End in an iconic 1969 Prince Spaghetti commercial.
Anthony Martin Yeti lives in Boston, on Prince Street, in the Italian North End.
As any faithful Radio Boston listener will know, our own Jamie Bologna took us on a journey through the North End with Anthony on the 50th anniversary of that famous spaghetti commercial. Jamie, hey there.
Hey, Tiziana.
So, Jamie, tell us about Anthony and what you learned about him when you spent time with him.
Yeah, I mean, he was just a really outgoing, kind, bubbly, friendly person from the moment I sort of cold called him at his job at the Dedham Courthouse to when I met him on Hanover Street, and the entire time I interviewed him there and walking the streets of the North End, he was just gregarious and giving and real and saying hi to people, greeting people on the street. In terms of his story, he told me that he came to the U.S. from Italy when he was 9. So that was in 1966, and came to the North End. And just 3 years later, he starred in that iconic TV commercial, the one that made Anthony a household name here and around the country.
I know this is a hard day. What is his family saying, Jamie?
Yeah, I spoke with his sister, Michelle, this morning, and she was just crushed. According to her, he died overnight in his sleep. As you mentioned, he was 63. He lived in West Roxbury and worked as a court officer. She told me that the rest of the family is devastated, and she described him as just a really nice guy with a heart of gold. And at least that last part I can certainly say was true. And I should also add that family was something that was really important to him. And he made that point to me a number of times in my interview with him and during, you know, follow-up phone conversations that we had. It was just always family first. I actually have some tape here from our conversation. Here's Anthony Martinetti last August with me in the North End reflecting on life.
Everybody's rushing to be someplace. Relax. You know, sit down, enjoy your family. They don't last forever. You know, my parents are 91. I mean, I'm blessed to have them. But I know people that lost their parents at a very young age. So you never know when your time comes. Enjoy your family. That's too, you know.
Life's too short.
Life's too short. You're right.
Jamie, you're going to play your report from last year that featured the commercial's 50th anniversary. But before you do, what do you want people to take away from it?
Well, I've re-listened to it a number of times today, and thinking about it again, I'm hoping that folks hear two things. First, that it was Anthony's kindness and his gregarious, outgoing personality, his willingness to lend a hand, even as a 12-year-old, that got him the gig in the commercial in the first place. And I think that's an important thing to remember. And second, just how important this idea of togetherness was to him, togetherness as a community, as a family. It's a theme that I think, of course, takes on particular resonance today, when so many of us are so apart from each other. I haven't seen you, Tiziana, since March. And of course, you know, we've lost so many of people to either COVID or the impacts of COVID. So I think as a tribute to Anthony, let's go to that report from last fall when I visited the North End with a 62-year-old Anthony Martinetti.
Anthony Martinetti.
Where are we right now, Anthony?
Moncada Street in the North End.
Oh, my
how
God.
How are you?
How are you, buddy?
I love you.
Love you, too. How you been?
Good, good.
Still smoking, man? Come on.
This is what it's like to walk the streets of the North End with Anthony Martinetti.
I know. My son's 15. I started late.
Oh, my God. 15.
Although he won't admit it, he's a bit of a local legend here. still recognized in his old neighborhood.
I remember getting letters, people say they named their kids after me, Anthony, and people saying, you know, my name's Anthony, and people, they stretch it out when they say it. It's the same way they do you know, in the ad, they sing it.
Did that bother you? Did that bug you?
No, it didn't bother me. I was like, you know, that's nice. You know, a lot of people, like it says, I named my son after you. That's an honor.
But let me back up, because maybe you've never seen the ad that made Anthony a household name. The commercial ran nationally on television for 13 years, starting in the fall of 1969, and it was produced by the then Lowell-based Prince Pasta Company. Now you can find it on YouTube. It opens with Mary Fiumara leaning out of a second-story window on Powers Court, yelling, well, I could do an impression of it or play the clip for you, but maybe I'll have Jim Botticelli, he's the author of the book Dirty Old Boston, Four Decades of a City in Transition, give us a taste.
Anthony! The minute you say Anthony, they know what you're talking about. Especially if you say it in that tone. Anthony! If you say it in that tone of voice, they know exactly what you're talking about.
You're talking about Prince and pasta. But in 1969, pasta was not really part of the mainstream. Italian food for many Americans was SpaghettiOs and Chef Boyardee. Here's how Paula Taylor, she runs the Food and History Culture Tour Off the Eaten Path, describes the commercial.
It's a little bit voyeuristic in some ways when you see Anthony Martignetti running through the streets. But then it flips to being back in the kitchen where you see his mother making the pasta and the family gathering at the table, and it kind of shoots back and forth. It's really like a documentary in some ways.
And it wasn't only spaghetti. James Pasto, co-founder of the North End Historical Society, says the commercial put people just like him into the center of American life for the first time.
It was exciting. It was exciting to see us on TV showing Italian Americans on TV, which we weren't used to seeing. It was kind of unworldly, surreal almost, because we were on the map of America.
So the ad had a big impact. I'll tell you more about that in a minute. But let's hear Anthony again talking about filming it.
And then the scene where, at the end of the commercial, where I come through the door, they says, okay, stand outside the door. When we say action, come in. So I, okay, so they says, no, listen, you've been running all this way. You got to act like you're tired. I wasn't an actor. I didn't know how to act tired. One of the guys that I was with, he made me run 15 times up and down the stairs until I got tired.
Up and down.
So when I opened that door, I was really exhausted. I wasn't acting. I was tired.
And the commercial ends like this. Everyone gathered at the table. The last one to arrive is Anthony, out of breath.
And as every family in the North End of Boston will tell you, Wednesday is Prince Spaghetti Day.
So I asked Anthony, how did this whole thing come about? How did a 12-year-old kid born in Italy come to star in an American national TV commercial? Turns out, ad men and TV producers walking around the North End were just about as out of place as pasta was in the American diet.
You can tell they didn't live around here, the people. So they asked us for directions.
What do you mean you could tell they didn't live around here?
Well, the way they were dressed, the way they looked, they had long hair. Back in those days, they were, you know, our parents always told us, stay away from the hippies, they're going to kidnap you. You can tell the way they talk, the way they you know, dress, the way they look. You can tell they didn't live around it. Plus, we didn't even recognize them. Usually in those days, you know everybody from the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So my friends were like mean to them, like, get out of here before it gets dark out. You know, typical punks. I just gave them directions. And then about a few weeks later, they asked me if I wanted to be on TV.
It was iconic.
Peter Saronic is a former Boston ad man and now at Emerson College.
I mean, it was sort of a standing joke that Wednesday's a Prince Spaghetti Day, and it's probably part of our sort of Boston thing, you know.
So the ad was meant to sell pasta, and it did, but it also sold an idea of family, of Boston and of Italian Americans. And in today's terms, it went viral. Of course, a lot has changed in the North End since 1969. Back then, Boston was Balkanized, and the North End was mostly Jewish and Italian immigrants. It was walled off from the rest of the city by the looming green central artery. Here's tour guide Paula Taylor.
It was fishmongers, greengrocers, butchers with rabbits hanging in the windows, chickens in the back, lots of people hanging out in the streets. I feel like the neighborhood felt more colorful. There was lots of awnings on the storefronts. You don't see that as much anymore.
Among the many changes, Anthony himself is now in his 60s and doesn't live there anymore. Lifelong North End resident Mary Fumata, who played Anthony's TV mother, died in 2016. And Prince Pasta is no more. It's no longer made in New England, and it's now just one of dozens of brands owned by a Madrid-based food conglomerate. But still today, if you stroll down Hanover Street, you'll get a distinctly Italian-American experience. You'll see pastry shops, markets, and delivery trucks double parked. And you'll also see a more diverse group of residents and business professionals in yoga gear, maybe even walking their dogs. You'll see a Chinese takeout place and a Bank of America. James Pasto of the North End Historical Society says the commercial takes us all back to an older idea of the North End, as it once might have been when it was a stopping place for new Italian immigrants.
I mean, I think the nostalgia is there now. It helped create something to look back towards, the North End of the 60s. It recreated the Italian-American neighborhood, in a sense.
So getting back to its impact, let's hear from Marguerite Bonapane. She's the author of 6 editions of the North End Italian Cookbook.
You know, it made people aware of pasta.
She knows a thing or two about the North End and about pasta. She's a former restaurant chef and owner, and she taught cooking classes there for more than 3 decades.
It is a good thing, which we took for granted, and there's no other food in the world better than a plate of spaghetti with sauce.
When she says taken for granted, she means for Italian-American families, pasta and tomato sauce was sort of a daily food. But for a lot of Americans, it was still exotic, maybe even foreign. Not anymore. Americans consume almost 6 billion pounds of pasta a year, or about 20 pounds per person. Although if you ask me, that seems a little low. But maybe the Wednesday is Prince Spaghetti Day tagline had something to do with that. Again, tour guide Paula Taylor.
People recognize it. What surprised me is people from other states recognize it. Having this tour, I get people on my tour from like rural areas of the country, urban areas. People from Texas tell me they love that commercial and that they were amazed it happened in the North End. I think in some ways that commercial also put the North End on the map as America's Little Italy.
For Marguerite Bonapane, now that the North End is very much on the map, it's also changed. And not just the neighborhood, but the culture.
No, those days are gone. As far as I know, it'll never be the same unless everybody gets smart and slows down.
Anthony Martignetti agrees.
Now it's like everybody's rushing to be someplace, relax, you know, sit down, enjoy your family. They don't last forever. I miss those days, Sunday afternoons, my brothers, my sister. So every weekend, the whole family, it was a family gathering. Now it's like you're lucky if you see your family once a year.
Why do you think that is?
Times have changed. I mean, things are so expensive now. People need to work 2 jobs. Back in those days, you paid $50-$60 a month.
For rent.
Now you're paying $3,000. Who can afford $3,000 a month? Not really.
So maybe you're feeling how I'm feeling right now. A little nostalgic for a simpler time. Maybe sad that there never seems to be enough time in the day to do all the things you want to do or see your family. And for me, this is the strength of the ad 50 years later, because I get it. At the end of the day, it's just a television ad. It's trying to sell a box of dried pasta, but it's also selling an idea, the idea of a family sitting at a table together for dinner. That simple idea changed how a lot of Americans viewed Italian food and their Italian-American neighbors. And now, 50 years after it first aired, the commercial endures as a way to talk about where we've been and what's changed. Again, Jim Botticelli, author of Dirty Old Boston.
Yeah, I guess we've made that Prince Pasta ad sort of a metaphor for the times we lived in versus the times we live in.
And even though it's the late Mary Fumara who leans out that second-story window in the North End to call Anthony, she's really calling us all to the table.
Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna in 2019, visiting the North End with Anthony Martignetti. Anthony died overnight at 63. As the Boston Public Schools are set to open with remote-only learning, and Boston will soon enter its 8th month living with COVID-19, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh joins us for our monthly check-in. Mayor Walsh, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And that piece right before this was awesome. I remember those commercials on TV. It was amazing. And also, they talked about the Italian family, but I think that was a lot of families used to have dinner around 5 o'clock every day. And Sunday was the big meal and everyone ate together. And times have definitely changed in a lot of households. But I think COVID have brought some of that family life back. I'm noticing a lot more people eating dinner together and stuff during the COVID crisis.
We've been hearing a lot about that, Mayor Walsh, actually, just this idea that we're back in the kitchen, we're preparing meals as a family, we're sitting back down together. Was pasta at any point a staple in your childhood household or your household growing up?
I grew up in an Irish household, so there was meat and potatoes almost every night, but my mother would make spaghetti for us, once in a while. It was probably Prince spaghetti and ragu sauce. That was our gravy, but it was always a special treat in my house. And then, as we got older, we got a chance to really taste real authentic Italian food. And I love my mother and her cooking, but having the authentic stuff was amazing.
It's nice to have some diversity in that, isn't it?
Yeah, it really was, But anyway, thank you. I just wanted to just throw that in there.
Oh, no, that's great. And I do want to invite our listeners to join this conversation, too. If you live or work in Boston and have a question for Mayor Walsh, call us at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. You talked about the fact, Mayor Walsh, that in COVID-19, people are back in the kitchen. They're eating more together. As I was thinking about today, it struck me we're almost through 7 months now since Boston saw its first positive tests. September will be the eighth month. And I wanted to start just by asking you, that's a long time. How are you?
I'm doing good. It's been a lot wearing on a lot of people, I think, including, myself. As I said before on the show, I live my life a day at a time. But what we find is, the decision we had to make 7-8 months ago, shutting things down, it was quick, and we had to. And as we think about opening up now with the world of COVID still being here, it's really complicated, whether it's work or restaurants or schools. Is probably the biggest decision that we have to make as a city, as a society, as a culture. How do we open schools? How do we do it phased in? How do we make sure that our students, our children, our parents, our teachers, and everyone's safe? So it's really complicated as we move forward here.
How are you feeling about how the city's sort of rode through, I know that's probably not the right word, survived through these first 7 months? Are there any specific moments or policies or decisions that you made that you feel really stand out as having been successful or effective so far?
Well, I think to date, our positive rate, our 7-day positive rate as of the 15th was 2.8% of all tests positive. We're testing about 1,800 people a day. We are right now, we are kind of in control moving forward as a city. We're seeing what's happening around the country and other cities around the country. And really, if we continue to do what we've been doing for the last 7 or 8 months, washing hands, physical distancing, wearing masks and things like that, and look out for each other, we can ride through this fall in a pretty good place. I think that, what jumps out at me the most in the last several months was, building a hospital in 5 days over at the convention center. I think that was really something that jumps out at me. I think it was, watching people wear masks and moving forward. And then on top of it all, George Floyd was killed. If people weren't stressed, there wasn't enough stress, then George Floyd got killed. And trying to understand, trying to make something out of that and having those dialogues and conversations. So it's been a very... 2020 has been one of those years that, we'll look back on in history. And I hope it's a turning point for our country. I hope it's a turning point that we're better prepared medically. We're better prepared, for whatever comes our way. And also around systemic racism that we finally, as a country, finally made the decision to address systemic racism from coast to coast, and not just in certain areas. And I've made it clear that we're addressing it in Boston and going to continue to work, but really addressing it coast to coast. So the year still has more time to go, but people are strong and people are resilient, and we just have to continue to live a day at a time.
The word unprecedented has always gotten thrown around, I think, probably a little too loosely. But this happens to be a case where You were the mayor of a city during an unprecedented time. Are there any decisions you made where you think, gosh, if I knew then what I know now, I would have done it differently?
I think, you know, we shut down fairly quickly, but I think we probably would have been better served if we had better direction from Washington in January to shut things down in January. Now, COVID wasn't here, really. Our first case of COVID wasn't until February, but we knew it was coming. And if we took the precautions as a country, now not everyone's going to do that, obviously, because we're seeing states still resist it to some degree, COVID. But if we took those steps, we'd be in a stronger position than we are right now. When you think about 5 million, almost 6 million cases of COVID in the United States of America, 177,000 Americans have died. You know, think that's a big number. And when you think about if we had, as a country, got ahead of this earlier, that those numbers potentially look very different. In Massachusetts, you know, we have nearly 9,000 people have lost their life. In Boston, 750 people. So, I mean, those decisions, if we got to them earlier, and you can't really blame any one person, but clearly on a national level, we were not prepared for this at all. And in that case, it didn't filter down to the states either.
So you talked a couple of minutes ago, Mayor Walsh, about one of the hardest things has been figuring out how to handle school reopening. And I do want to talk about that. We've had so many voices here on Radio Boston over the last couple of weeks. And you know, strong voices that we're doing it too slowly, strong voices that we're doing it too quickly, strong voices that we can go back in person, strong voices that we can't. Boston, as of Friday, is now set to start fully remote with a staggered hybrid entry plan for October and November. How are you feeling about that decision, and do you feel that now that is the right call?
Well, I mean, for today, I mean, and I say that because we're basing it on science and we're basing it on data. The Boston Public Schools extended the timeline for the phase reopening so that we could assess the health data between phases, allow parents and families to have choice, so it's an opt-in situation for the different grade configurations. We need to make sure that we meet the needs of our most vulnerable students and provide safety for everyone, so we're working through that process. We're taking a very gradual measures approach because it's the right thing to do to ensure families feel confident in sending their kids back to school if they choose, and that teachers and staff feel secure in their positions, because there's a lot of different feeling here. We want to make sure that we also recommit ourselves to addressing achievement gaps. And that's one of the things that I'm really concerned about by not having in-classroom learning is the growing achievement gap, particularly for our Black students and Latino students. So, so we think about as we move forward and all these things, these have been difficult decisions. The phase reopening, just real quickly for people that are listening, Tuesday, September 8th, teachers will report not necessarily to school, but they're going to begin preparation for teaching in a hybrid model in their classroom. September 21st, which is a month from about a month from today, we're going to have all students are going to begin remote learning. On October 1st, the option of an opt-in hybrid learning for students with the highest needs. October 15th, the opt-in for students, the younger students, for K0, K1, K2, October 22nd, opt-in for grades 1 to 3, November 5th, opt-in grades 4 to 8, and November 16th, opt-in 9-12. Now, in saying all that, we're able to move these phases back if we have to. We're not going to move them up. This is the start date. But if we see our number go to 4% positive rate for testing or anything above that, we will not start school. So we'll just push all of those dates down a week or 2 weeks, whatever it might be. So we're at 2.8 last week. We haven't gotten this week's number yet. I'll have them the next day or so. The week before, we're at 2.6. The week before, we're at 2.8. So we've been staying in the area of 1.9 to 2.8% positive rate for the last, say, 10 weeks here in Boston.
How do you talk to parents who say, I can't not know, but because of my job, because of childcare, because of home? I imagine there are a lot of parents who are both wanting it to be based on the science, but also feeling like, I got to know what's going to happen with my kids so I can plan.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, the one thing that we want to make sure we're making sure the schools are prepared. We're doing a lot of work. I'll get into that in a second, but we're making sure that the classrooms are prepared for a safe place. So the only people that will be allowed into a school our teachers and children and staff in that school. So we want to make sure that it's a safe environment for them. Every school is going to have, we're purchasing foggers to mist the schools in the district. Those foggers are the, you see them on TV, people spraying down and killing any potential infections. We've ordered 4,700 pieces of plexiglass. We have...
Mayor Ross, just because you brought up foggers, how often will those be used?
They'll be using them probably every day in the common areas. And then the way school would be, we have Group A, Group B. Group A will be Monday, Tuesday. Group B will be Thursday, Friday. So every Wednesday, Tuesday night, Wednesday, will be a deep clean in the building because no one will be in the building. And then over the weekend, we'll be doing the same thing in the building. Putting signage, PPE and signage and directional signs in the school. So kids won't be able to use the gyms and they won't be in the cafeterias and things like that. So we're going to be really limiting where they go. It's going to be mostly the classroom.
And what do you make of the state's recommendation that's recently come out that they want teachers to teach from inside the classroom, even if all the students are connecting and learning remotely?
Well, that's one of the things that we're working on now. We were going to do that in Boston, and that's why I think it's really important for us starting. I think the week of I think it's like the 12th or 13th, whatever day it is. Teachers are going to be in the classroom remotely. I mean, they're going to be in the classroom physically and learning the technology that we have so that when kids start the 21st, our teachers, we're anticipating our teachers to be in the classroom. But again, we have to make sure everything's safe. The teachers have to feel safe. I mean, our teachers are parents. Our teachers are caregivers to their elders. Our teachers are concerned about their own public health as well. So we're working through all that right now.
Let's go to the phones, Mayor Walsh, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Matthew from Brighton. Matthew, you're on the line with Mayor Marty Walsh.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking the time, and thank you, Mr. Mayor, for having me.
You're welcome.
Yep. My question is about the rental market in Boston. I was wondering if the mayor's office has a better idea of a looming eviction crisis here once the rental moratorium is lifted, and if there's a plan to deal with that.
Yeah, no, great question. First and foremost, we're hopeful that we've put a lot of programs out there for rental relief here in the city, trying to have people access rental relief if they need it. We've created a fund, I believe it's a $6 million fund. People have accessed it so far to the tune of about $2 million fund. These are folks that are not eligible for any type of unemployment benefit, or then they're not bringing any income in. I also have, you know, one of the biggest concerns I have with the rental eviction that's looming is that most people won't have the ability to have counsel with them in court. And I have a piece of legislation at the State House that I was hoping to get through there, hasn't moved yet, that would allow people to have representation in court. A lot of what happens is that, you know, the landlord has representation, the tenant doesn't, and they're in front of a judge or a clerk magistrate, and not having that ability to have representation really, really makes it difficult. So we're working trying to figure that piece out, and then also continue to work with our landlords that, you know, once the eviction moratorium is lifted, that there's not this large exodus. I'm asking landlords to work with their tenants to make sure that if they have arrearages, that they set them up on some type of payment plan, because we don't want to see all these folks being evicted out of houses. We don't have a number yet. There's been a lot of talk about it, but we don't have a number of what that would be potentially of potential evictions in the city.
Let's take another call here, 800-423-8255. We've got Jared on the line from the South End. Jared, you're on with Mayor Marty Walsh.
Hi, Mayor Walsh. My name is Jared. I want to commend you for your commitment to ending systemic racism in the city. And also, I'm a lifelong South End resident, and I benefited for decades from the Harry Tubman House and its own United South End Settlements from the various programs there. I'm just wondering, would you support USIS to sell the Harry Tubman House to another nonprofit to keep it for, say, 100% community use rather than having it demolished soon for luxury condos?
It's already sold. We can't do anything about that right now. It's already sold. And I think that the company that bought it, they're working with USIS and they're working with other organizations to keep a presence of nonprofits there.
Let's take one more call, Mayor Walsh. We've got Cheryl on the line. Cheryl's calling from I-93. Cheryl, you're on with the mayor.
Hi there. My question is why you don't close Newberry Street to vehicles and allow restaurants to expand seating out into the sidewalks and the streets? Thank you.
Great question. Thank you for that. I'm not sure if they requested it. I'll look into that. I know we did it on Hanover Street. At least we didn't shut down traffic, but we have traffic going down the middle. I'm not sure if that was requested, but that certainly would be open to the idea of doing that, or at least keeping a lane open for traffic and having people there. But that's the first that's brought it to my attention. I'll look into it. Great question, though.
So, Mayor Walsh, let's talk a little bit more about schools, but here I'd like to talk about universities. Colleges and universities are in the middle of reopening. How are you feeling about the plans that universities like a BU, who holds the license for WBUR, or Northeastern have in place? And what are you watching most closely as tens of thousands of students come back to the city?
Well, first and foremost, I think we have more college students per capita than any other city in America. Students come from all across the country here, and it's certainly one of our strengths. But I'm concerned about students returning to Boston, especially from areas around the country where COVID cases are high. We've talked to them about the colleges, about their density on campus. We're working with them on plans on move-in days. We're helping them with their housing options to reduce density using hotels. We've asked every college, university in the city to submit their testing and quarantine plans to the Boston Public Health Commission for review. And we've received the plans from nearly every single school. I'll give one example. Boston University has posted all of their testing online, so it's live. So you'll see how many tests they've, I think they've done over 12,000 tests and maybe a handful of positive cases. So they have good plans for testing, but we have to make sure when these students come into Boston that they're tested frequently, and we have to make sure that there's a policy, not just for on-campus housing, but for students that live off-campus.
So, Mayor Walsh, I want to turn to another issue, one that's emerging now. The city's planning a project in Roxbury to improve Milnea-Cass Boulevard, dealing with traffic, making it safer for pedestrians and cyclists. But part of that plan means taking down a number of mature trees, which has advocates concerned. I want to ask you to tell us a bit about the project and ask you to respond to concerns over the negative environmental impacts of taking out mature tree cover in an area with a lot of asphalt and a lot of heat.
No, thank you. The top priority of this project is to improve road safety. This is a corridor that has more crashes on it than almost any other street in the city that we need to address. The process redesign, we are looking at building interventions against floods, improving street walkways and adding bike lanes, adding trees to preserve the expanded tree canopy. Currently, there are 125 trees out there. 25 of them, if I understand, are dead. We're going to be adding 205 trees. I might be wrong on that number, but we want to resolve resolving the design conflict between the priorities has been a focus of all the work we've done over the last several years. Off of the story today, I'm going to be convening a meeting here with the city team to determine how we can get to an outcome that prioritizes the safety that I just talked about, but also addresses the environmental concerns that have been raised before we advance on the project. So it's, this has been this is a 10-year process, by the way. This project's been going on before I became the mayor of Boston. It's all lined up now with the funding, but I'm going to have a meeting this week to talk about, see if there's what we can do here.
So just two things. I believe the reporting that I've read said it's about 140 trees that are in plan
to
be replaced.
Yeah, I'm probably wrong. Yeah, sorry, 140 trees.
And I'm hearing from your Mayor Walsh that you're actually in response to the concerns that there's an environmental racism dimension to this, which is, I know you know, is a term that critics have used. You're actually thinking you're going to reconsider this and there may be a different outcome. I just want to clarify if that's
right. I think we have to look and see what can be done. The problem we have is that in order to widen the roadway and be able to fit in, the bike lanes and things like that, that sometimes, unfortunately, the trees are in the way. When I say they're in the way, they're right where they need to be. And I want to just see if there's anything we can do here to be creative, to be able to preserve some of the trees. But if the project's to move forward, we can't preserve all the trees. And I understand what people are saying and feeling, but this project also is about public safety. This project's about making sure that, as I mentioned, one of the highest rates of crashes happen on the street. So it's also about making sure that the investment we'll make, it's an investment in the community, in Roxbury, in the South End, connecting both of those neighborhoods to the Boston Medical Center, to the highway. So all of this will be taken into account.
How concerned are you about predictions that in neighborhoods like Roxbury with a lot of open asphalt, the temperatures are going to hit 90 degrees most summer days in the foreseeable future due to climate change? How concerned are you about health safety, public safety, and the intersection with race? I know you declared racism a public health emergency earlier this summer.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm very concerned about it. I mean, one of the things that we've done here, we've taken a very aggressive position on the environment here in Boston. You know, we're one of the things we did in the very beginning was making sure that we're the first city on the East Coast to be within everyone within 10 minutes walk of a park in their neighborhoods, more green space, open space. We're demanding more open space and green space when it comes to any development that's happening in the city of Boston, in Roxbury, in Dorchester, in Mattapan, in all of those different neighborhoods. We have many parking lots and lots that are there. And as people think about maybe redesigning or building on these lots, we want to make sure that there's green space there. We have to do more and more of it. There's no question about it. I mean, we put a lot of plans forth, you know, Resilient Boston Harbor, reducing carbon emissions in the city of Boston, Climate Ready Boston. These are all programs that we're doing because of that reason.
So in our last couple of minutes, there is one other news of the day item I'd like to talk to you about. Last Friday, the Boston Globe took the Boston Police Department to task for resisting providing public information when public information requests happen. We've experienced that here at WBUR in the past. The ACLU is now suing the Boston Police Department for that. And I wonder, in a context of a conversation about police reform, you talked earlier about the killing of George Floyd earlier this summer. Do you have concerns about the trust effect between BPD and the community if there's this systemic resistance to providing information? What do you want to do about that?
One of the things that we have to do is look at the police department and look at their ability to turn the records around quickly. The amount of requests that the police department get on a daily basis, particularly in the last 4 months, are just really very, very high. The ACLU asked for information in June of this year, and the police department was working with them. And, you know, June to, I don't know the timeline, I think it's 4 or 5 weeks they're supposed to turn around, and they weren't able to turn around that quickly. And I mean, the lawsuit's pretty quick. I mean, it's a pretty fast lawsuit. But again, I'm not making excuses for the police department. That's something that we have to work with them on in making sure they have the proper staff to be able to turn these requests around. I mean, you know, during George Floyd, you know, they were getting 17, 18 public record requests a day, and these requests weren't simple. It's about gathering the data, gathering the information. So I think we have to support them with more people to be able to get this information turned around quickly. You know, when the press requests information, we should be as transparent as possible. We should get this information out as quickly as possible. That's something that my administration is very focused on, and that's what I want to do here. And I think that's, in some cases, it's lack of staff. I can't get into too much about the request that the ACLU gave and why that information wasn't all passed back.
Mayor Walsh, I appreciate you joining us today. Any parting thoughts in the last 15 seconds or so for listeners in Boston right now?
Yeah, I just want to make sure that people vote. You know, we received 80,000 mail-in ballot applications by the election department. 20,000 mail-in ballots have been returned. All mail-in ballots must be received by August 26th. So we want to make sure that if you want to vote, you can place your ballots in a drop box here at City Hall or any of the early vote locations. And also, there's a case today that's in front of the Supreme Court. Every vote counts, and I support that case in front of the Supreme Court.
Let you go. Sorry, Mayor Walsh. I'm going to run out of time in 10 seconds. That's Boston
Thank
Mayor
you.
Marty Walsh. Thank you so much.